Session number 26579.
Mr. Clark, rail 3. We're talking about your time on basic training with 26th Infantry Training Centre at Gordon Barracks, Aberdeen. And you were there from January to February 46. Now, is there anything else before we leave there? Anything that happened, or is that a pretty well it?
I was thrown in close arrest. I was put in the guard room.
Well, tell us about that. What happened?
It's to do with food. Yeah, you mentioned the food, and I didn't remember this. I'm on top one day, after about the third or fourth day in the army, I'm top for my lunch. And when I had finished my lunch, we had plates, we were issued with two plates. And when you finished, there was always a big basin of water that you wash your plates and eating irons in. And I went in this day. When I came out this day, after my lunch, I went over to what I thought was the washing water. I started to wash my plates. The next thing I knew, I was on my backside. This big cook sergeant, she grabbed me and flung me. I've been washing my plates in the soup. And she ordered me straight inside. So I'm sitting there in the cell in the guards, I'm crying. I was crying my eyes out. And then walks RSM. And he said, "What's all this about, young man?" He's an RSM in the Highland Light Infantry. RSM McGregor, the Highland Light Infantry. And I told him what happened. He burst out laughing. He said, "Go away, you silly wee shite." He said, "Go back to your platoon and I'll sort it out." And that was it, you know. And I thought I was going to die, you know. I thought I'm going to get executed here, like, you know. And that was the only thing that really happened to me there, like, no.
So now you had your 6 weeks. Then what happened then?
At the end of 6 weeks,
was there a passing out?
We passed out. We did a pass out parade on the square.
Tell me about that.
It wasn't very much. There was about three squads, and it was a question of marching on, being inspected by a commanding officer, whom I can't remember at this stage, and then we marched around the square, eyes right, eyes front, and marched off the square, and that was it.
Were there relatives there, either yours
no,
or anyone?
No, there was nothing like that then, no.
Was there any competition between squads?
No, none whatsoever.
So what happened then?
We finished the training on the Thursday, Wednesday, pass out parade on Wednesday. We then had to pack all our kit. Oh, during that spell of 6 weeks, we wore khaki berets with a Bakelite General Service badge. No insignia on our shoulders whatsoever. And when we passed out on the Wednesday morning, we were then paraded at the quartermaster's stores, those of us who were going to Scottish regiments, and we were issued with tartan flashes, TUSs, and our cap badges. That was us badged into the regiment. That was on the Wednesday afternoon, I can remember. On the Thursday morning, we packed all our kit and we moved about 4 or 5 miles in towards Aberdeen to a camp called Hayton Camp.
Hayton?
H-A-Y-T-O-N, Hayton Camp.
And what was this? What unit was that?
Now, this was the 10 weeks...
Continuation training.
10 weeks continuation training. And
was it still the same unit? I mean, was it still a 26th infantry?
No, different. I forget the number of it.
Okay.
Continuation training. I forget the, but it was definitely a separate unit. Anyway, we arrived there on Thursday morning, and to say that our accommodation was Spartan, to put it mildly.
Now, why was that?
We had no lockers, we had nothing. We had a straw mattress, once again the three blankets, the two pillows, and that was it. In other words, a kit bag and what we stood up in. Then this is where the fun began. This is where we had to do our daily layout of our beds. You had your blanket, fold your blankets in the usual box fashion, and then you had to start laying out your shirts, underwear, socks and everything on the bed. certain layout and your equipment.
Do you remember what it was, or the general pattern of it? Why you had to do it as well? What was it all about?
For the simple reason, we didn't have any lockers. And they didn't want people to have their stuff all stuffed in their kit bag for weeks and then. So they made sure that we had the layout. So and anything that we didn't require for laying out, we had kept in the kit bag. But on an inspection, the platoon commander or company commander can say, right, let's see what's in your kit bag, you know? But the whole setup was so brutal, it was unbelievable. The washing equipment, I mean, before it, Gordon Barracks, we had the water, hot water indoors, proper ablutions. These were outdoor ablutions, wooden structures, with running down the centre was lead sort of channel, and all taps off these pipes, and all cold water. We didn't have any hot water.
This was February.
Yep, and the weather was brutal, and we had one shower a week, hot shower a week. That's all we were allowed. But at the end, by the end of the first week, it was no problem. We're just going out there, you know, even just in your underpants and having a good wash, like, you know, and share. And we just get so used to it. And this was always part of the training, like, you know. And once again, my sergeant was a little bloke called Sergeant Burns, Cameronian.
What was he like?
He was a pretty good guy, actually. He was very laid back. He was a wartime soldier. He came from Burn Bank, just outside Hamilton, Jimmy Burns. And he was very laid back, but a very good instructor. He knew what he was on about. And the NCOs in my room, a bloke called Thompson, another Cameronian. I forget who the other instructor. Thompson was a bit of a pig.
In what way?
He was very, very uncouth. Uncouth bastard. And one example was that one day the little fella next bed to me, a little bloke called Mitchell, who came from Douglas in Lanarkshire. And what was it that happened now? The corporal came in and he said something to this little Mitchell. And Mitchell gave him a smart reply, like, you know. And this Thompson drew out and belted him, punched him. He split all his mouth with a ring on his finger. And I leaped in and got the corporal round the throat, flung him on the deck, like, you know, held him. Just at that, the sergeant walked in. Oh dear, I thought, Clark, here we go, you know. Because by this time, you're getting a bit sort of wise, like, you know, you're like equivalent to streetwise. Anyway, the sergeant comes striding up straight away. She's right, get up, Clark, get over there. She's right, corporal outside. So I took him outside. She said, what's wrong with your mouth? So she said, oh, I said, I fell. What did you know? I said, tell the truth, Mitchell. Tell the sergeant the truth. Like, anyway, what happened was this, that the corporal was shifted, moved. The little fella Mitchell got his mouth fixed up, sent up to MI room, got his mouth fixed up. And the sergeant pulled me aside. He said, you'd tell me what happened afterwards, won't you? I said, yeah, I'll tell you what happened. You know? So I said, I'll see you at lunchtime. So that was it. And anyway, all sort of blew over. But this Thompson, he always seemed to... how would you put it? He was always trying to needle you, trying to provoke you. This air of provocation about him, like, you know?
And this isn't part of the training. This isn't to make a man of you. This is just...
That's right, yeah. But the thing was, we got another NCO in, a big bloke called Sandy Henderson. And Sandy was a smashing corporal. He cut Cameronian again, like, you know? And anyway, we started... That weekend, we were getting sorted out, getting our kit all sorted out, ready to start training on the Monday.
So what was different about the training? Or can you take us through what you were doing with this continuation training?
The continuation training was much a larger variety of training. It was much tougher, in as much as that it was harder in this respect that the NCOs were harder. The NCOs, we now had to virtually become from boys into men, as it were, training-wise. A classic example was PE. We then started training with logs.
Tell me about that.
We'd get out in the morning, do maybe 15 minutes in the gym, and then outside we'd strip off our tops, and we'd get outside, and with boots on, socks rolled down, the blue pants, PE pants. We would then get these logs, and you would put on the log according to your size. But I was always the front guy, I was the littlest guy. We walked right up, and then you did certain movements at the on orders of the PE instructor, which involved throwing the logs up over your head and doing all sorts of manoeuvres with the logs. And this was to ensure that the upper part of your body was toughened up. And it also it gave you that the timing, sense of timing, how to, if you didn't get the timing right, the log could come down and smack on your head kind of thing. You know, this was a sort of thick reasoning behind it. And it was to help you to time things, like, you know. Then the funniest thing I ever found was going out to play football at 8:30 in the morning or 8 o'clock in the morning when they were a game of football, which I couldn't believe at that time in the morning. However, that was because of the training program and the availability of the football ground, right, you know.
What about assault courses?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about what they were like?
They were pretty tough. They were basic, very, very rugged, but tough. Barbed wire, you crawl under barbed wire, up over walls, across poles, wooden poles, and then it also taught you how to help each other over various obstacles. How to two guys could help one guy over, and you all helped each other. And this training again, I found that we were gelling more and more. In fact, you hung together like shit to a blanket, you know, and you thought that you were actually in opposition to the instructor, but in this, not in an insubordinate way. It created a team spirit, a tremendous team spirit. And then we would do, instead of route marches, the PE staff would do 5 mile runs. In their basic, in their PE kit, and that, you know, we'd do maybe a 4 or 5 mile run, and then we'd done the route marches eventually, 10, 12 mile route marches with the usual breaks in between.
And how tough were they? Or did you take it in your stride?
Well, yeah, the thing was, they were getting easier because we were getting fitter. This was the great thing. The program was very, very well balanced, in as much as that the fitter we got, the easier we found these obstacles, and it was all part and parcel of the training, and it gave you a lot of self confidence. As I felt myself getting really fit, I thought, "Whoa, terrific!" Like, you know, nothing became a problem to you physically.
Were you introduced to any new weapons while you were there?
Yep. We then were introduced to the 36 grenade.
Tell me about your grenade training.
Well, the grenade training was first of all, the 36 grenade was a wonderful little grenade.
That's the Mills bomb.
The Mills 36. A lot of people were under misapprehension. They usually think it was because it was all in segments. It was 36 segments. Now, that was a myth. The Mills 36 grenade was called the 36 grenade simply because it went through 36 processes before it was accepted. And once again, it was a very simple weapon, in as much as that all it consisted of was the grenade itself, explosives inside, and you had this detonator. You placed it into the end of the cap, and then you screwed the cap on. The base plug. The first thing you did when you got a grenade, you unscrewed the base plug, checked to make sure there's no detonator in there. Then you place it back on. Clean the grenade. If you got a grenade brand new, there used to be a lot of grease. So So it took quite a bit of cleaning. Then when you went on the grenade, you were taught how to throw the grenade properly.
Yeah, now tell us about that, because it's not thrown as you'd expect.
Sorry?
It's thrown a special way.
That's right, yeah. What you did was you got the grenade, and you were told, pick up the grenade, prepare to throw. And when you got that command, prepare to throw, you flung your body around so that your side was facing the enemy or the target. And then when you were given command throw, what you had to do is you check to make sure that the base plug was out, the pin was out, the safety pin was out. Then you right back and you threw the grenade with your arms in an arc, threw it, and then it was 1, 2, 3 down, because it was a 4-second fuse. Now, also there was a 7-second fuse, but that was used in an anti-tank capacity. When you had an anti-tank grenade, there was a certain thing you used to fit onto the end of the rifle. Forget what the name of it was, but you could fit this attachment onto the rifle, the 303 rifle. It was a cup thing. Put the grenade in there, squeeze the trigger, and you fired it, and that took 7 seconds before it exploded. So that was the two rolls of the grenade, like, you know?
The thing you described was basically a cricket bowling action.
It was basically a cricket basically bowling action, yeah, yeah. Not a, I would say a fast bowler arm action. Not if you were a spinner, no. You'd never live to tell a tale. But
How far could you throw it?
It, once again, it depended on the person himself. I could throw it from, say, maybe 20 yards. I could manage about 20, 25 yards.
Because they're quite heavy. They're heavy.
I'll tell you, later on in life when I became an instructor and I was teaching a grenade throwing, I had a chap drop the grenade after he'd pulled the pin out. And I managed to pull him into the safety bay, and it actually went off in the dunes, you know. So he got a clip around the ear hole.
Yeah. Did you do live grenade training in your continuation?
Oh yes, yeah, yeah.
What was it like? Because it makes a lot of people nervous.
Yeah. Well, we went out there and we did training outside of Aberdeen. There was lots of space there that was used by the army for field firing and what have you, you know. And this is where we did it. A place called the Colliston Ranges, umpteen miles from Aberdeen. And this is when we did all our field firing. We went out there and we fired LMGs. Oh, all live firing. Live grenade throwing. But that was more or less a few weeks later on, like, you know.
But you had no problem with it?
None whatsoever. No, I was one of the lucky guys. I could handle weapons no problem.
And it didn't make you nervous?
No.
Did you get the Sten then? I think it was
the Sten. Which eventually became a Sterling.
That's it.
The Sten was very, very basic as well. Absolutely basic. The reckon used to cost 15 bob to produce. And it was very, very basic. But still, at close range, a very effective weapon. I used to like firing the Sten.
Did they tell you that if you dropped it, it would go off? I mean,
This could happen.
But did they warn you in training? Because some people say they did used to warn
you. I got warned in training. Said, don't let this weapon go, because if it hits the deck, the cocking mechanism could be activated by hitting the ground.
The safety catch was on.
That's right. Yeah, that was the only unreliable thing about the Sten. I mean, you could drop a Sterling, that'd be all right, but a Sten was, as I say, it was so basic. For the simple reason that during the war, they had to be like Spitfires. They had to build them like Winky, getting them out to the men on the ground.
Now, what would you say? One thing people say about the Sten was that it was so inaccurate that you couldn't hit the other side of the room hardly with it. What was its accurate range?
My interpretation of this is this: that if you were at one end of a room and you're firing a bloke at the other end of the room, if you missed him, it was down to you. It's as simple as that. Because that, to me, the answer would be to put it on automatic and give them a couple of bursts. And if you didn't have with that lot, then you might as well put in for discharge. You know, But no, I mean, it was virtually a close-range weapon, very close-range weapon. And as such, it did it served its purpose.
Now, you didn't have the Stirling then, did you? The Stirling gun?
No, that came later on in life.
Now, what, were you introduced to the heavy machine gun? It would be the Vickers
no,
still, wouldn't
no,
it? No. What about the mortars, the 2-inch?
2-inch mortar, yeah.
Tell me about the 2-inch.
Sorry, we get taught the 2-inch mortar there as well.
Tell us about the 2-inch mortar.
Once again, very, very basic, a little base plate, and no sights. There was no sights on this thing. It was just a pad halfway up so the operator could hold the weapon. And you virtually fired it by lining up the barrel of the weapon. And number one would hold the weapon firm, number two would put the bomb, and as the bomb went down, it fired. It was just the firing pin, projected firing pin, would hit the base of the
rocket. Like a spike at the bottom.
Yeah, like a spike. And off she would go. Now, there was two angles you could fire at, high angle and low angle. If you were laying down smoke, then low angle was the thing. You always use low angle. That means that you brought the barrel down and lower the trajectory, as it were. But if you were firing at a specific target, high explosive, then high angle was the answer, like, you know.
And how accurate were they?
Once again, it depended on the man firing it. I've seen some wonderful mortar firing, and I've also seen some shocking mortar firing. You know, it depended how the guy reacted to the situation.
And what were you like on it?
Not too bad. Not too bad.
As was I say, it a specialist job? Because
no, it wasn't a specialist job. No. The
3-inch was a specialist.
The 3-inch was a specialist job. Yeah.
Any other? What about the Piat? Was that still going on?
Oh.
Did you get training on that there?
Did we get that? Yeah, we got the Piat there. That's right. Yeah, we got the Piat training.
Now tell me about the Piat.
Projector infantry anti-tank. Oh, my God. The problem with the Piat was, it was the terrible thing about the Piat was it had a massive spring. And this is what used to do the damage. Now, if you went to cock the Piat, and if you didn't get it right first time, you were in trouble, because the thing would just spring back on you, and could break your shoulder, or break some parts of your body. The other thing was, when you were actually firing the weapon, you had to have a super hold of it, because if you didn't, once again, the spring could damage you. And I can remember one little chap who was doing a live Piat firing. He was a very slight little lad, and he hung on to this Piat, and he fired two shots. He fired the first shot, and it moved him back about 3 feet, and he was rigid. He was in line with the Piat, loaded up, put his number two, put his second bomb in, fired again, and that guy had moved about 6 feet, because I think he was rigid with fear. And that's the power of the Piat. Once again, in the hands of a guy that could handle it, be all right. It was a weapon I never liked.
Why not? Just this.
Because to me, I didn't feel as if I was in control of the weapon. And I think that was the attitude among all of us. I think we were more scared of the weapon because of that.
Was it accurate? I mean, all right. if you were a decent operator, could you hit a target?
Depends on the range. You have to hope it's for to knock tanks out. So if you got a tank within a decent range, then you could knock it out. And after all, the members of the guy in the last war won the VC, a guardsman. He fired it from the hip and knocked out a German Tiger. And he got the VC. Never mind knocking the tank out, it's a VC for firing the thing.
Did any other weapons you were introduced to at continuation training?
Not then, no, that was about it.
What about the tactical training? did you start doing what I'd call manoeuvring in the field?
Basic tactics, that's right. It was section command work.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was just how to move as a section. Fire and movement, basically. The infantry section, is commanded by a corporal and a lance corporal. The lance corporal being second in command, he was in charge of the Bren group, number one and two of the Bren group. Section commander had, say, maybe another eight guys. So what we used to practice was that when the rifle section had to move, the Bren gun would go out in a flank and teach us how to fire onto the target. And then when we moved into position, then the Bren group had to move and we would give them covering fire. So the Bren group, so it was just a question of the two covering each other. And that was about it. That was the basic tactics. That was all we got then.
That's all you got then?
Yeah, for the simple reason, we should have gone on late after that 10 weeks was finished, we should have gone on for another 10 weeks of what they called battalion training. Now, what happened was they stopped that battalion training before we...
Okay, Now, anything else about the continuation training? We've covered quite a lot of training there, but...
It was rugged. But it made us so fit. Plus the fact we were allowed to get out in the evenings, we were allowed into the town, Aberdeen.
What was that like, your first time out? That was your first time out as young soldiers?
Oh, we were dead chuffed. And the thing was this, that you took a pride in yourself, your turnout. That was one of the big things about it, you took pride in your turnout. And the people of Aberdeen were absolutely super. They were absolutely super.
In what way?
Every way. You get into a pub, bloke would buy you a drink. And this is another thing, they had all these, like I told you at Hamilton, where a lot of these organisations had money. And one night, Saturday night, about 5 o'clock, we'd just come back from tea, and the young officer came into the room, he said, right, he said, you, six of us, you're going to a party tonight. One bloke said, oh, sorry, sir, I've got a bird down to... He said, forget the bird, he said, you're going to a party tonight. And sure as fate, up come this two big cars and took us this hall, but a mile down the road. And it was what they call a welcome home party. This welcome home fund for the troops. And that night, I've never had such a lovely night. We had bags of food, booze and everything. And there was a band playing there. And through that, several of us got to become friends with some of the civilians there, I became very friendly with a couple whose son had been killed in the war, whom I forget all about them now, but the people were very, very nice. There was never any trouble. We never had any yobs coming after us.
No trouble with the young lads. I was just going to say, people of your own age, you would.
No. I can never remember any trouble at all. And we had a lovely big nappy club there in the... just off Union Street, off the main street, one of the side streets.
In Aberdeen?
Yeah, the big nappy club.
What did that offer?
We had a lovely restaurant, dance hall, bar and everything. It was really well organised, So the off-duty hours in Aberdeen were terrific. We never had any problems. But I was sorry to leave it. When it came time to leave,
anything else before you leave? You were there from February through to May, 10 weeks?
Yeah, right. Our final training was we had to go up to these Colliston Moors,